Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about the 2006 animated film Monster House. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hi, Adam.
Hello.
How are you?
I
say tentatively.
Yeah, I'm not going to give a whole spiel here. I'm sure I've got a blog for that. You know, hanging in there. I think everyone's struggling at the moment for all sorts of different reasons. But glad to be doing the podcast and discussing an interesting film.
Yes. I agree. There's a lot going on, isn't there? Personally, politically, globally, epidemiologically. But I'm glad to be here talking to you today. A bit of distraction and, you know.
Yeah, same here.
What we are talking about is Monster House. I know we said at the end of the last podcast we were going to do Creeped Out, and we did want to do that, but could not for the life of me find a platform where all of the episodes were available. So yeah, as Creeped Out didn't work out, we're kind of falling back on a film that's on Netflix.
And on everything. It's basically on every streaming platform.
Yeah, because it came out in 2006.
Yeah,
I was so surprised when I realised that. I thought it was much more recent.
Oh, that's interesting. So I watched it upon release.
Okay, yeah. I didn't even heard of this film, and then I realised it came out in 2006, which is just a tremendously long time ago, really. Oh,
God, it really is.
and also incidentally happens to be the 1 year of my life that I have no specific memories from.
What, at all?
No, and I can't think of a single thing that happened to me in 2006. Like,
okay, so I mean, I was, I think, like around the end of sixth form, coming up to university, that kind of period. So I remember watching this with my girlfriend at the time, and now academic collaborator, Helena, both quite enjoying it. Watching it in, I think what was, like her family house's like guest bedroom or something, had really horrible yellow walls that made me feel really queasy and dizzy for some reason.
Right, like actual yellow wallpaper.
Yeah,
style.
Yeah, it had quite a profound effect on me. Genuinely made me feel physically unwell.
Wow.
Being in that room for too long. I don't know, maybe there was a carbon monoxide leak. isolated that room, I don't know. But so I do have quite strong memories of watching certain films in that room, but always feeling a bit ill when I'm doing so. But yeah, I remember us both enjoying it at the time.
My GCSEs in 2005, so...
Oh, okay.
2006, I would have been in... start up sixth form.
And surely you remember sixth form, right?
Yeah. No, I guess I don't like have a complete black hole, but yeah. I don't remember anything like memorable, specific that happened that I associate with 2006.
Yeah.
2006 just kind of happened.
Well, what you didn't do that year is watch Monster House.
Yeah.
I do wonder if the reason for, you know, this is a fairly obscure film that's clearly gained more attention in recent years, or certainly greater distribution. I do wonder if that's because the screenplay is primarily written by Dan Harmon, pre-internet meme fame of Rick and Morty.
Yes, yes. Doesn't, not much of the Rick and Morty flavour to it, I think.
It's, yeah, I think that's fair. There's certainly no kind of post-ironic pickle content in Monster House, which is nice. But, I mean, he wasn't the only person who wrote the screenplay. So he co-wrote it with Rob Schrabe and Pamela Petler. And, yeah, it was produced by Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg. Well, I say produced by them. Produced by Image Movies and Amblin Entertainment. So in terms of the animation, which I know you want to talk about, this was apparently something of a follow-up to The Polar Express, that film in which Tom Hanks plays everyone.
Wow.
I don't think he's in Monster House. I guess the house could have been modelled on Tom Hanks's face. if so, I didn't notice, but...
Subtle.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a this kind of has what I've heard referred to as a Tupperware title.
It's a Tupperware title.
So yeah, you label your Tupperware. What's inside the Tupperware? It's a house that's a monster.
Oh, I see. So not that it keeps things fresh inside, but also pollutes the planet in the long term.
I mean, okay, so
it's high concept, right? You know, there's a house and it's a monster. It's a monster house.
It's a monster house, yeah.
As the tagline says, there goes the neighborhood.
Okay, so it's kind of set in a sort of upper middle class American suburb, and our main character, DJ, lives opposite a spooky old house, which is inhabited by an old man called Mr. Nebbercracker, who's voiced by Steve Buscemi, but in this film he's not like, "What is up, fellow kids?" but instead is like, "Get off my lawn, kids."
Yeah.
And he kind of frightens all of the local kids and confiscates any toys that fall on his lawn.
I will note quickly that DJ's real name is Daryl Jake.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Just, you know, his parents aren't those kind of parents who have just called their kid DJ or, like, you know, laser or, I don't know, USB. But yeah, you know, that's the handle he goes by.
His speaking of his parents, they go away for the weekend, and DJ's best friend Chowder, real name Charles, I think.
Yes, Charles Chowder Maxwell.
Okay,
it might be his middle name.
Yeah, it might be. Maybe his parents really like clams.
Yeah.
His best friend Chowder comes over and with his brand new basketball, but the basketball inevitably bounces onto Mr. Nebbercracker's lawn, and Chowder kind of goads DJ into trying to get it back. As he comes up to the house, Mr. Nebbercracker emerges, and he's this kind of wild-eyed, crooked-backed old white man, and he shouts at the kids, "You want to be a dead person?" And sort of picks up DJ and shakes him, and then keels over and dies.
Yeah, he seems to shake himself into a cardiac arrest.
Yeah. As he's taken away by the paramedics, a key falls out of his pocket, and this really upsets the house, basically, and the rest of the film is kind of a struggle between the kids and the house that is now definitively out to get them.
Nice.
Mm. And it's CGI animated, as you mentioned, with some motion capture, which was pioneered in the Polar Express, apparently. Yeah. Which I haven't seen.
I mean, with the Polar Express, as I said, the motion capture has mostly been used on Tom the Ham Hanks. Mm. And, you know, he's got his recognisable, genial ham face. Right. Mm-hmm. So it gives it this uncanny charge. Whereas, you know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I know Buscemi, but I don't know Mitchell Musso or Spencer Locke. I mean, I know Maggie Gyllenhaal, but then Z, the babysitter, doesn't really look like Maggie Gyllenhaal at all.
No.
So, yeah, even though it's motion capture, this mostly is discernible in the movement. Mm-hmm. Of the characters rather than any kind of facial similarities to the performers.
Yeah. It definitely leans into the grotesque in some of the character designs. It's very like knobbly, kind of oversized faces and hands. It makes Mr. Nevercracker genuinely quite frightening when he sort of looms towards DJ and kind of see his kind of red rimmed eyes and flaring nostrils.
Yeah. I'd say it's got an element of the Shrek to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a DreamWorks movie, but it's definitely leaning more towards the DreamWorks aesthetic than it is Pixar.
Mm-hmm. I found, as you mentioned, DJ's babysitter Z, she has a jerk-ass boyfriend called Bones, whose face is a particularly kind of horrible sort of gaunt plasticine-y kind of nightmare.
Yeah, and very old. Right, I mean, presumably we're meant to think this guy's in his early 20s. He looks like he could be pensioner age.
Yeah.
I mean, he really is a what's up fellow kids character.
Oh, yeah. He's taking on that mantle. And he terrorises DJ's cuddly rabbit, which puts him eternally in my bad books and... made me actually quite annoyed when he wasn't permanently swallowed by the house.
Yes, I do wonder, I mean, we're skipping ahead a little, but I do wonder if that was a producer's decision.
Yeah, it felt quite tacked on.
Yeah, they're basically interspersed amongst the credits are some little clips showing that the characters we thought had been eternally eaten by the monster house are actually fine.
Yeah.
Which seemed like a bit of a shame.
Yeah. but yes, we'll get to the house eating people. But if we kind of fit this into our taxonomy of children's horror, it's kind of set up as a kind of kids versus adults sort of situation at first.
And kids not being believed by adults, like we see in the Demon Headmaster.
Oh yes. The kind of the kids versus adults sort of gets subverted as the film goes on, with the sort of revelation of the house's true character and such. It's definitely kind of Paranorman adjacent, but does better than Paranorman, in that Paranorman really kind of fell down on its having very lazily kind of stereotype characters, and I think Monster House is a bit better at that.
I think Monster House also has a little bit more in the way of genuine thrills and chills. Like, one of my issues with Paranorman is the fact that it, you know, it plays out as a series of kind of pastiche references to other older horror films, but it never really feels like a horror film itself.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, Monster House is genuinely quite a scary film.
Yeah. I did want to...
I mean, in terms of what we've looked at previously, if anything, it reminded me of William Sleater's books. Like, particularly Interstellar Pig and that kind of...
Ah.
In as much as you've got this kind of suburbia setup, you've got this of, and then you're introducing a supernatural element, that lots of the adult characters don't at first believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I guess, on some level, it's very much the kids striking out on their own on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the kids, right, on some level, they very much are children, but they're also kind of aware of the fact that they're having to step outside of childhood innocence to kind of get stuff done. And they're kind of a bit kind of self-referential and weary about this. Like, oh, all right, yeah, I guess we better step up to the plate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As well as DJ and Chowder, we have Jenny, who is a neighbourhood Girl Scout, who gets drawn into the fight against the house. And I think most of the kind of joy of this film is the novelty of the house being the monster, and kind of seeing the ways that the house becomes animate, particularly like its carpet acting like a tongue and its kind of rotten board teeth, and the way it sort of sucks things gloopily into the lawn. Like, it's quite fun.
Yeah, and it gives things a sort of Southern Gothic flavour. I think, you know, this isn't noticeably set within the South. But this idea of the house itself, right, as a space that has taken on a lot of grief and bad feeling, and that these negative emotions somehow stored within the house itself.
Ah, oh, like Hill House.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly like Hill House. It does feel like a Shirley Jackson story on some level. That, you know, on some level, Monster House, and we'll get into this, is a film about grief and the grieving process. And the idea that you can't just kind of push these things away or repress them, that they'll find an out, and that in this case it's the house that ends up explosively expressing all of these bad feelings.
So it's kind of the mystery of the film is sort of, why is this house seemingly sentient and attacking people?
Why house bad, basically?
Indeed. what's the nature of Mr. Nevercracker's relationship with the house? Because at the beginning, it's kind of set up to sort of seem that he's the bad party, or, you know, he's setting the house on the kids, but that's not, in fact, the full story. The kids end up talking to a guy who tells them that he reckons that a human soul must have become merged with the house. They put this together with the kind of neighbourhood rumours that Mr. Nevercracker killed his wife, and decide that the house must be inhabited by the vengeful soul of Mr. Nevercracker's wife.
I mean, they're taking this information, as you say, largely from a character called Reginald Skull Skolinski, who is a local video gamer, basically.
Yes.
Who does not seem like a reliable source of information in any sort of way, shape or form. Clearly doesn't even want to be talking to the kids, he's too busy gaming. But because of his pro gamer achievements, you know, the kids really look up to him.
Yeah. So on that dubious recommendation, they decide they need to strike at the heart of the house and kind of concoct this sort of elaborate plan with a dummy sort of on a vacuum cleaner laced with vast quantities of cough syrup.
trying to get the house to hallucinate so thoroughly that it implodes, presumably.
Yeah, what was the cough syrup about? I didn't quite...
Yeah, like, I don't really get is Costner an explosive? I mean, you'd think that it wouldn't be, but I can look this up. Yeah, that's why we have the internet.
They're trying to cure the house's heartburn.
Oh, I see.
Because that's making it cranky. No, I don't think that's it either.
What does the house's heart even look like? Because it's not like just a big heart, is it?
I don't think so. It's kind of just a yawning pit, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I mean, it seems like a bit of a shame. I don't know, I'm sure, like, I'm trying to think what would make a better heart than that.
Like a big, like, conglomerate of white goods.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I can see that. Or, I don't know, an inflatable mattress filled with blood.
Oh.
But yeah, I don't think we actually really get to see the heart of the house, sadly. No. So, we do, however, get to see the uvula of the house.
Yes. Yes, yeah, so they're trying to get this cough syrup laden dummy into the house, but are foiled when the police come by. And I think we kind of need to talk about this, the police scene and characters kind of while we're here.
Okay, yeah, sure.
There's one white cop and one black cop, and the white cop's kind of stern but genial, and the black cop's kind of a hapless rookie who's sort of trigger happy and wants to solve every situation with violence. And is also the only black character in the film, as far as I remember, definitely.
So this is Nick Cannon as police officer Lister, and then Kevin James voicing police officer Landers, who has also appeared in the film Paul Blart Mall Cop
from, really?
Yeah, from 2009.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I mean, what did you think about?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. It definitely sits uncomfortably, and obviously, you know, we're recording this at a moment of state-sanctioned police brutality in America.
Mm-hmm.
White on black violence and brutality, as shored up by a white supremacist state and government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. This isn't a film that spends lots of time giving us character depth.
No.
And I don't know if, say, the inept but well-meaning but trigger-happy black cop is a stereotype per se, but
yeah,
this character is very clearly the only black character in the film. And there's something here about kind of equating whiteness with, I wouldn't say reasonable use of authority in the film, because that's not quite what it's doing. But as you say, the black cop is the rookie cop, who clearly isn't able to handle his gun correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly like meant to be a comic relief kind of character, but the fact that it's presenting the character as very, like, gung-ho about violence, it's just, it feels
when you're seeing lots of white men, right, using violence in a grotesquely well, racist and, I mean, disproportionate isn't even a strong enough word, right? But, yeah, so I can see the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not suggesting, I don't think they thought about this very thoroughly.
No.
Which is maybe part of the problem.
And
also, as we said, this film was made in 2006, which is not like a materially different time in terms of the violence of policing, but is perhaps a different time in terms of widespread thinking about it.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's also, I mean, I think pretty much any aspect of character development feels a little bit tagged on in this film, because frankly, it's a film about the Monster House.
Yes, you know, yes.
It's not, say, like with, when, you know, right back in the start of the podcast, we discussed Box Trolls.
Uh-huh.
Right, and both of us were pretty upset by Box Trolls, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Partly because of high expectations, but partly because the transphobia and the kind of trans panic stuff in Box Trolls is really structurally integral.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's a main part of the narrative. Like,
yes.
Box Trolls as a film couldn't really exist without that. I do think the more problematic aspects of Monster House could be removed, right? Quite
yes.
easily.
Yes.
But yeah, we're sort of circling the drain, I think.
And yeah.
talking around this, you know, if personally, I think, you know, the best way to respond to systematic violence is through action and active allyship, rather than neurotic quibbling, right? don't get me wrong, you know, I'm very good at neurotic quibbling. But yeah,
as well as neurotically quibbling on this podcast, I have been donating to fundraisers. There's so many resources going around for like bail funds and mutual aid funds.
We'll put some links in the show notes, but I'd recommend, say, the Minnesota Freedom Fund, who pay criminal bail and immigration bond for those who can't afford it, basically, and at the moment is very much focused on paying bail for those who have been arrested during the protests, largely, in this case, people of colour.
And yeah, it'll be a couple of weeks probably from recording this to when it comes out, but you know, there's still be plenty of organisations that could do with support. It's not going to go away in that time.
So the cops don't get to stick around for too long, right?
No,
they get eaten.
Yeah, the cops get eaten by the house, and the kids also get eaten by the house.
End of film.
So they get swallowed up into the belly of the house, and they kind of find what they think is confirmation of their theory that Nevercracker killed his wife, when they see photos of them together.
And then some kind of, entombed corpse?
It's pretty creepy. I thought this is like the scariest moment. They go down into the basement and find this kind of concrete entombed body of Constance, a wife, that then sort of cracks, revealing a skeleton beneath, which is a genuinely disturbing image that I was quite proud of them for.
Yeah, especially when there's been so much kind of muddling or blurring the lines between the metaphorical and the literal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So at this point in the film, I was quite invested in the idea of the house as a body. And so,
yeah.
You know, trying to work this out was quite disturbing. So, okay, well, we've got the corpse of Constance. Is the corpse within the belly of the house then? Has the corpse eaten her? You know, is she on some level part of the belly, eating the people who comes into that? Is this some kind of cannibalistic corpse house belly thing?
Yeah.
I think because of the way that the metaphorical and literal becomes blurred, it doesn't really quite make sense. You know, you can't get to an exact meaning of what's going on here, but that kind of makes it more disturbing.
And you don't know kind of if when they crack the concrete around the skeleton, does that release something? Or can it be more? I don't know. It probably can't be more malevolent at that point. The kids kind of get ensnared by slinkies that have been confiscated by the law over the years, and kind of pipes. And then, as you said, Jenny has the idea to grab the house's uvula to make it vomit them out onto the front lawn. we get the joke that it did make me laugh when when Jenny says they should grab the house's uvula, and Chowder says, oh, so it's a girl house.
Oh, Red.
I know, it's so
beneath
silly.
Beneath your dignity.
It is, I do. It's a very silly joke. And I shouldn't have laughed. And yet I did. And now you all know that I'm a silly person.
And that I'm not.
And that Adam is not a silly person. Adam is a sensible person.
A sensible person who made a face.
Yeah.
So they are vomited out.
Yes. And here comes the twist, which is that Nevercracker is not dead, nor did he kill his wife. He sort of comes back from the hospital and is like, well, tells them that the story of how Constance was a circus fat lady who he fell in love with and rescued from the freak show, and was so in love with her, and he decided to build a house for them together. But Constance was taunted by kids and neighborhood trick-or-treaters ran away from the kids, and while the house was still under construction, she tripped and fell into the foundations and got covered in cement.
It's all a bit like a plot line from American Horror Story Freak Show, to be honest. And a bit of a reductive portrayal of circuses or freak shows. There's quite a lot of, you know, I don't want to get too academic-y, but there's a lot of really interesting academic writing about freak shows. It wasn't as simple as performers were, you know, prisoners who were always locked up in cages and had no autonomy over their roles or performance, and they just sat around waiting to be rescued. You know, without getting just pro freak show, it's more complicated than that, basically, as you'd imagine. But then, hey, I know this is a kids' film, and it's sort of going for a slight fairy tale thing. And I did think it's nice that Constance is being shown as desirable.
Mm-hmm.
That Nevercracker clearly adored Constance, and yeah, you know, there's a bit of the White Knight coming in to save her, but, you know, she is also shown as romantically desirable to Nevercracker.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of nice. That's not something, you know, in so many kids' films, as we've kind of talked about before, fat characters are just there to be the butt of jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really happening here.
I mean, from some Paranorman as well, sort of the Norman's best friend was the kid who was just the constant butt of fat jokes. And, you know, Paranorman came out in 2012. This House came out, as we keep mentioning for some reason, in 2006.
Can't get over how long ago that is now.
I know, I really can't.
You're a long way from sick form.
So I think, yeah, I think in some ways this film felt more less
jerky.
Yeah.
It's not as obnoxious as Paranorman, let's be honest.
Yes.
That said, obviously Constance does become a monster house.
She does, yes.
So, you know, let's not go too far in lauding this as, you know, the greatest portrayal of an overweight woman that, you know.
Yes, yes. Yes, she does become a monster house, it's true. It's a shame.
Well, I guess grief does terrible things to us all, including transforming us apparently into monster houses. And it is a good looking monster house. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, this for me is where the animation really worked. You know, the character designs are a bit lumpen and...
Quite lumpen, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they're not great. But the house itself is pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once the house is getting all, like, splintered floorboard teeth and... it looks great. It's a very exciting monster house.
Shall we texture of the week then? While we're...
Oh my gosh! Yes, we should texture of the week.
Okay.
Because I'm not even in my own house. You know, I've been at Antonia's for most of lockdown. So, but if you give me a sec, there's some stuff over here.
I'll just assemble my instruments.
Okay. Texture of the week.
The week of the week.
Cool, like rattling windows in a gale.
So I have to give this film film props for starting with a texture.
Ooh.
It's a very texture-heavy beginning sequence that I really enjoyed quite a lot, which it starts up with the kind of close-up of an autumn leaf, with the veins of an autumn leaf falling off a tree, and you sort of follow this leaf as it tumbles around in the wind and gets stuck in the wheels of a kid's tricycle, and that's the inciting incident to and a kid being shouted at by Mr. Nevercracker. But I certainly enjoyed that early texture representation.
And, you know, old-timey film critics were always about the wind in the leaves. Like, if you read André Bazin or Siegfried Krakauer, so old film theorists who wrote about the art of cinema, they were always going on about the damn leaves. It's almost like only cinema can capture the movement of the wind through the leaves. And this is normally trying to capture something of the way that live action cinema can preserve the ephemeral and the transient and the sort of beautiful moments of God's creation permanently on screen, whereas you know, hear Monster House saying, yeah, well, CGI can do it too. You know, we may not be able to make very nice faces at this stage, but, you know, we can make a good leaf.
Yeah, they could.
Yeah,
they
it's a good crispy leaf.
It's a good crispy leaf.
Well, I guess my text here then will be the Monster House towards the end of the film, when it's been partially destroyed with a digger. Yeah, I was going to say some kind of like, I was just sort of thinking of Transformers, you know, like, I think this is in my head, right, bit of a digression, but waiting for my bike to be fixed up at Halfords, I went to like some plastic hellscape shop. I can't even remember what it's called. I'm calling it like The Range, but it's, I don't know. So it's like homewares and other things. And I looked around at the toys section, and there was a Farm and Sam Mecha.
Yes, I saw that in Home Bargains.
Oh, it was somewhere like Home Bargains. It's not enough that Farm and Sam, you know, isn't the humble stop motion creation that he once was. He's now a sort of CGI Farm and Sam. We've had to go full on Mecha Farm and Sam with him like transforming into a fire engine.
So there's Mecha Postman Pat as well.
Oh no, is there?
Yeah, yeah.
What's next? Like a Mecha Clanger that can transform into some soup.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds pretty good.
And
he's got a really thin face, the Mecha Fireman Sam. Like, I think like the Mecha transformation has taken a lot out of him. Anyway, a bit of a digression. I didn't like it. was not keen on Mecha Fireman Sam.
Okay.
But I am...
Objection noted.
I am keen on Mecha Monster House.
Yeah.
Especially once it's been dug away at a bit and looks very kind of toothsome and dilapidated.
I'm giving an honourable mention also to the house's carpet tongue, which sort of rolls out of its mouth / front door, kind of scooping people up into its rotten wooden jaws.
You've got to love a hairy tongue.
Yes.
As the residents sing, smelly tongues smell just as they look.
Do they?
Yeah. Yeah, good old smelly carpet tongue.
It does look smelly.
It does. So yeah, but ultimately the poor house doesn't get to be very sated, because it gobbles down all these different people and a dog and such, but it just ends up, oh, I mean, they don't even get regurgitated, right? The house gets destroyed.
Yeah, this sort of Nevercracker realises he has to destroy the house and let Constance go. It's sort of ambiguous whether this means she... Is this giving her peace, or...?
Destroy the monster house you love.
Yeah.
It's like that Oscar Wilde poem, isn't it? You know, each man destroys the monster house he loves.
It's quite prophetic, that one.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of dynamite, and
you gotta have dynamite. Like in the Demon Headmaster in the last one, they're always planting bombs everywhere.
So yeah, according to Wiki here, Constance's ghost is released.
Oh, good. cool. Good for her.
And DJ apologises to Nevercracker for his losses.
The film ends with DJ and Mr. Nevercracker giving away the toys in the basement that have been stashed there all these years. As you said, unfortunately, with horrible bones, the jerk boyfriend crawling out of the wreckage.
And the two cops and the dog and anyone else who was eaten, I guess. There is a video game of Monster House.
Is there? Ah.
Released the same year for the PS2, GameCube, Game Boy Advance, and DS.
Oh, I love the GameCube.
So yeah, you basically have to navigate through the house and destroy the house. So all the enemies are various, you know, household appliances and features. Sounds a little bit like the kind of forgotten rare game Grabbed by the Ghoulies, which you have to also mostly smash up a house.
Mm.
Yeah, not very edifying, but you know.
Mm.
Few video games are, if we're honest.
Oh, Adam, have you played Journey? This is completely irrelevant. I'm sorry.
No, I've seen it's like the kind of desert based kind of
Oh my gosh,
windy walking simulator.
Yeah, it made me weep at the end, like because it was so beautiful and uplifting.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so that's something I've got to be doing.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I've mostly been playing Pathologic 2. You spend most of your time trying to find eggs and then trading them to small children for paracetamol and antibiotics. So, you know, it's been an appropriate game, I guess, to play during a pandemic. But I can't say it's a very happy game. So, you know, maybe I need to play something a bit more optimistic.
I mean, yeah, I've been playing, mostly been playing Animal Crossing.
Are you still on the Animal Crossing?
I'm still on the Animal Crossing. I have now my favourite villager, who is Bob, who is a purple cat. And I've been giving him a pretty dress to wear, like, almost every day.
Aww. But I heard, right, in Animal Crossing, when you write letters to the villagers, they don't even understand.
I mean... I don't really write them letters. There doesn't seem much point. The on-screen keyboard is horrible. I don't voluntarily use it.
So you could literally write a letter being saying like, you are a stinky head and I don't like you. And like, they'd be like, oh, I got a letter. How nice.
Yes.
Well, I suppose there's only one feature. Well, I mean, what other things do you spend your time doing in Animal Crossing?
Oh, well, I mean, you plant flowers.
Okay.
You try and, like, make nice flower colours by crossbreeding your flowers. You dig up fossils and try and make complete dinosaur skeletons in the museum.
I mean, it definitely sounds very wholesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's lovely.
That's lovely.
Good. You're obviously famously in debt to a raccoon.
What?
Tom Nook is the boss of Animal Crossing. Is a raccoon who raccoon land baron. Yes, who you are. Constantly in debt to as you try and upgrade your house and build buildings and structures for your island.
Okay, can you like overthrow them?
Well, I mean, this is the I kind of, you know, imagine the sort of if Animal Crossing had an ending, it would probably be that you kind of had to destroy your entire island to defeat like the sort of the enormous glumping specter of Tom Nook, who's grown mad with power and money.
Okay.
And you have to personally destroy all of the things that you have painstakingly paid for by shaking trees and stuff.
So kind of like the ending to Monster House.
Well, funnily enough, yeah. And then you have to escape from the island with, like, and you can only choose one villager to save.
Oh, I see. What, before it explodes?
Before it explodes.
Wow. That's great. Well, clearly Animal Crossing needs to be covered in Still Scared Children's Horror sometime soon. Right. Any final observations?
No, I'm clearly just going off on Animal Crossing fantasies at this point.
You're housed out.
Yes, I'm all housed out. I quite like this film.
it's quite good, isn't it? Like, you know, the kids are quite likeable characters. Does have a very good monster house in it. You know, yeah, it's straightforward, but yeah, I'd basically recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it showed me that definitely one thing happened in 2006, even if I didn't experience it personally.
Oh, that's good.
I've no idea what we're going to do next.
I don't know. I mean, there's been the potential for a Residents podcast Still Scared crossover. That might be in the works.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I'll explain that more thoroughly when we're not recording. You know, we've got Eerie Indiana, potentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure we've got lots of tricks up our sleeves.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, it just remains to say, I hope all our listeners are as well as can be in this time, and
do what you can to uplift your community and show support. Also be mindful of your own health and your own needs. You know, these are difficult times.
I'm sure it's slightly absurd coming from a children's horror podcast, but you know, we're all people, we're all in this together. Our intro is by Maki Yamazaki, our outro is by Joe Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson. I'll put all their details in the show notes, so you can check out their stuff and support independent artists doing cool things. You find us on Twitter at @stillscaredpod, or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Do you have a signer for us, Adam?
Not really. You know, I guess if the call is coming from inside the house, listen, you know?
All right, catch you next time, spooky kids.
Bye.
Bye.